From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Today, we conclude our Planet Money series on housing, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. As we explained earlier this week, Fannie and Freddie were strange hybrids. They were created by the government with a mission to increase home ownership, but they were also incredibly profitable private companies. In 2008, at the height of the financial crisis, the government saved them from collapse, and that has cost over $130 billion so far. Still, Fannie and Freddie's significance to the housing market has only grown. Over the last year, they funded two-thirds of U.S. mortgages. NPR's Tamara Keith has this story on the debate over what comes next.
It's now very clear that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were a bum deal for taxpayers. They reaped huge private profits and ultimately stuck taxpayers with the losses. The government now runs them, and it's costing a lot of money. So it's not all that surprising that so many people here in Washington, D.C. are saying the same thing.
We need to wind down Fannie and Freddie and substantially reduce the government's footprint in the housing market.
Goal one is to get the taxpayers off the hook. Goal two, or part of one, is to make sure that the taxpayers never again will be find themselves in this situation.
I think they should be abolished. The only question is, what do you put in their place?
That was, in order of appearance, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, Republican Congressman Scott Garrett, and Congressman Barney Frank, a Democrat. So we've got the Obama administration, an influential Republican, and an equally influential Democrat. And they all seem to agree. But wait, what did Barney Frank say at the end there?
The only question is, what do you put in their place?
That's where all the agreement falls apart. But to help you understand that fight, now a public service. I am going to attempt to explain what Fannie and Freddie actually do. When I bought my house, I went to the bank and got a loan. But the bank didn't want to keep that loan on their books, so they sold it to Freddie Mac. Freddie Mac bundled up my loan with a bunch of others into a mortgage-backed security and sold it off to banks, pension funds, and foreign governments. Now, a foreign government, like China, say, wouldn't lend me money to buy my house directly. So why would they buy a security made up of mortgages like mine? Because Freddie Mac promises that if I stop paying, they'll make up the difference. That's the service Fannie and Freddie perform. They guarantee the mortgages of American homebuyers like me. And that makes it okay for huge pension funds and foreign governments to loan us money to buy our houses. For decades, the U.S. government implicitly stood behind Fannie and Freddie. Now it's explicit. The question really is, in the future, do we need the government involved in mortgages? And if so, how much? Dwight Jaffe says, not at all. He's a professor at UC Berkeley who studies mortgage markets.
If I were here telling you why we should get the government out of the beer business, you wouldn't be very surprised. In fact, you would say, well, why would we ever get the government in the beer market? Mortgage markets lending is the same story. Why would you ever want the government in it?
Jaffe points to European countries with better home ownership rates than here in the U.S. who don't have the government involved in mortgages. What he's saying seems so incredibly reasonable. And yet, not many people agree.
So let's make it very clear. Let's have a government role right at the front.
Lawrence Yoon is chief economist at the National Association of Realtors. That's right, realtors. They're saying, government, we need you. You don't often hear business lobbies asking for more government intervention. But for Yoon and the realtors, it's absolutely necessary. The realtors are key players in what some call the housing industrial complex, along with the home builders, the mortgage bankers, and others. This group benefited from the existence of Fannie and Freddie. Yoon and the realtors are now pushing to replace them with a new government agency that does a lot of the same stuff. And they're using the same arguments they used in support of Fannie and Freddie. Housing isn't like beer. Yoon says it's special.
It's just ingrained in the American mindset to say, I own a property, I own piece of America. I think that's all good for the country.
Yoon and a lot of others warn if the government pulls out of housing too far, loans will be harder to get, interest rates will go up. Without a government guarantee, all those pension funds and foreign governments who lent me money to buy my house won't want to anymore. People like this guy.
We typically are one of the largest holders in the world of agency mortgages.
This is Scott Simon. He works at a money management firm called PIMCO. He buys a ton of the mortgage-backed securities created by Fannie and Freddie. If the government backing goes away, he says a lot of investors wouldn't take the risk on borrowers like me.
If it's not the banks, if it's not money managers, and it's not overseas, who exactly is going to be this magic pool that takes $1 trillion of mortgage origination every year and puts it on their balance sheets? And the answer is we don't know.
So you've got people like Dwight Jaffe saying you don't need the government at all. You've got Scott Simon and the realtors saying without the government, none of this works. And so, as sometimes happens in Washington, policy wonks everywhere are trying to find a middle ground. A little bit of government, but without all that pesky risk to the taxpayer. One idea floating around makes the government's role explicit, but more limited. Private companies shoulder most of the risk, would take big losses in a crisis, and the government would only come in as a last resort. But to Bethany McLean, that starts looking a whole lot like a new reconstituted version of Fannie and Freddie. McLean is co-author of All the Devils Are Here, a book about the financial crisis. She says Fannie and Freddie started out small and limited, too.
You can put all the safeguards you want in place. You can do this with the best of intentions, and everybody will say, oh, we're going to do this so that it's safe this time, so that these companies with the government guarantee aren't taking that much risk, and it will start off that way.
And then, inevitably, McLean says we'll forget what it was like before. The housing market will get better. The companies will start taking more risks.
And we will be right back where we were before. So the most likely solution is really a recreation of Fannie and Freddie, except everybody will pretend that it's not.
And that would be tragic.
Congressman Scott Garrett is a Republican from New Jersey, and he's head of a subcommittee that will play a critical role in deciding whether McLean ends up being right.
Every day that we don't wind them down and eliminate them and end them totally means it's another day that they're guaranteeing another mortgage that effectively could fail the next day that you and I have to pay taxes for. We have to stop the bleeding and not allow it to reconfigure to a day that it could start bleeding all over again.
One of Garrett's Republican colleagues recently introduced a bill that would end the government bailout of Fannie and Freddie, but it probably doesn't have enough votes to pass. So Garrett and others are pushing a separate set of bills that would keep the mortgage giants around, but on a shorter leash. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
You can hear Planet Money's entire series on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at npr.org/money.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is NPR News.
Later this week, U.S. carmakers announced their sales figures for the month of March. Sales have been improving, and this week's figures are expected to show that trend continuing, but some auto industry insiders still have concerns, as we learn from NPR's Sonari Glinton.
Recently, things have been relatively good in the car industry. Sales, up. Profits, up. Even perceptions of the U.S. auto industry, up. Then, news from the Middle East and Japan.
Major things like this could throw you a curveball and slow down that sales rate.
Lonnie Miller is an auto analyst for Polk Marketing. He says automakers probably won't be hurt this month by supply disruptions from Japan, but next month, that's another story.
I'm certain that people are going to really start reporting deficiencies in their sales by next month in April.
Chris Hobson is an analyst with IHS Automotive. He says this is all happening when stuff was starting to get good for Detroit.
The timing couldn't be worse for a double shot for the industry at this point.
Hobson says we're still not sure exactly the extent to which the crisis will affect car production in Japan or the U.S.
If the worst case of all these double shocks, you know, oil prices continue to go up, the crisis in Japan exacerbates, and the unknowns are still unknown, the longer it will take to bring everything back online.
Hobson says he can't predict how long it'll take to get production back online or how high gas prices will go, but he can say they probably won't be good for auto industry profits. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block, and in this part of the program, the huge challenges facing Japan's businesses and its entire economy. First, the big picture. Damage from the earthquake and tsunami could exceed $300 billion, and that doesn't count the cost of disruption to the economy caused both by the natural disaster and the crisis at the nuclear plant. From Tokyo, NPR's John Idstey has this story on how Japan's economy will try to recover from the setback.
Japan is the third largest economy in the world. It's a rich country, so there's little doubt it will recover. The question is, will it end up hobbled by even higher government debt and slow growth, or will the response to this ordeal propel Japan to a higher growth trajectory? Even before this disaster, the Japanese government was deeply indebted. That's in stark contrast to appearances in a fancy downtown Tokyo hotel. Its upscale shops suggest the country is very rich indeed.
26,495 yen.
This is where I met economist Naoyuki Yoshino, a professor at Keio University in Tokyo, to talk about the country's economic challenges.
Japan looks like a very wealthy country, yes. But however, we are indebted very much. Japan's government debt is almost twice as much as GDP.
That means the debt equals 2 years' worth of the total output of the Japanese economy. That's led some analysts to wonder whether Japan can reasonably finance what it needs to pay for the recovery. The only way to do it, says Yoshino, is to raise taxes. After all, he says, taxes are quite low in Japan.
So there's a room for Japanese people to pay for their reconstruction.
Will the Japanese people agree to that?
We have to do it because there are so many people who haven't suffered.
But even if Japan can finance the hundreds of billions of dollars needed to rebuild, its economy is still likely to be hurt seriously by a long-term electrical shortage caused by the crippling damage to the nuclear plant at Fukushima. Some analysts predict the Japanese economy will contract this year by nearly a full percentage point because of the power shortage. Professor Yoshino agrees it's a serious situation.
Energy is one of the key issues in Japan. Tokyo and other regions has a power shortage. So that will damage for many, many industries, including services and financial industries.
Manufacturers, including electronics factories and auto production lines, may be hurt the most. Nissan, for instance, has delayed production of its all-electric vehicle, the Leaf, because the utility TEPCO has instituted rolling blackouts that could continue through the summer. While in the next year or so things may be difficult, Professor Tatsuo Hata, president of the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo, says the disaster may be a catalyst for reform that could help the economy in the long run.
There's a huge potential for Japan to grow again.
A starting point, says Hata, could be breaking up the big regional electric utilities, which would make energy and production costs cheaper. He says rebuilding the coastal fisheries destroyed by the tsunami is another chance to boost the economy to a higher level. The old fishery was dominated by small-scale, aging fishermen and inefficient production.
And so I think this might be the beginning of such restructuring. Not everything can change, but in the fishery and electric utilities, things might change.
Michael Alphant, an American entrepreneur who's lived and worked in Japan for 25 years, has no doubt the country will come out of this disaster stronger economically.
I'm 100% confident. I'm even more than confident. I guarantee it.
Alphant owns a software company called Fusion, and he's also president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan. He says the ability to endure and overcome these kinds of challenges is part of the Japanese character.
Give us 3 years, and we will be back ahead of where we are today. And I think anyone that would opine to the contrary doesn't really know Japan.
All of these reforms end up being political challenges. Alphant, Hata, and Yoshino believe a generation of young politicians now emerging has a chance to meet those challenges. John Itzty, NPR News, Tokyo.
And one major challenge is reviving small businesses in Japan. Many along the coast remain closed. Some suffered earthquake damage, others were flooded by the tsunami, and some near the crippled nuclear plant can't get supplies. NPR's Jason Beaubien has been talking with business owners.
Toshifumi Kinjo ran a hair salon for 25 years in the coastal city of Tagajo, near the regional hub of Sendai. The tsunami flooded the entire first floor of his salon. Kinjo washes the grit out of his barber chairs and scrubs them with a paintbrush. Mud is everywhere. Much of the waterlogged contents of his shop sits in piles on the sidewalk. His plate glass window is smashed. But Kinjo is in a good mood. Kinjo says he's happy to be alive. He points to the top of a cabinet that's about 6 feet above the ground. That's where he took refuge during the tsunami.
Because the tsunami came, the wave just came up to here on the wall below the shelf where I was hiding. Basically saved my life. If it had gone much higher, I really don't know what I would have done.
Now he's faced with another challenge, how to get his hair salon up and running again. The neighborhood around him is devastated. There's no electricity or running water. He says the lack of water makes the cleanup extremely difficult. He's hauled water here to his shop in 8 red jerry cans. There's an elementary school near my house with a swimming pool, Kinjo says. I've been filling these cans with water from the pool and using that to clean. He says he's lucky because despite his family losing 2 cars to the tsunami, he still has access to a vehicle. The buses and trains aren't running here, and he says it would be very hard to try to repair his salon without a car. A few miles inland in Sendai, many shops, restaurants, and other businesses also remain closed. Downtown Sendai, which is the largest city in the heart of the disaster zone, wasn't flooded, but it did suffer some earthquake damage. There are big cracks in the sidewalk in front of the shuttered train station. Several large office buildings downtown are cordoned off with caution tape. Most hotels in Sendai are shut. Tatsuo Kono, the manager of the 125-room Bel Air in Sendai, pats the headboard of a bed that toppled over during the quake. The earthquake damage to his hotel was minimal, and most of it has already been repaired, but the Bel Air remains closed. The city gas line is off, Kono says, so we have no heat or hot water. Their linen service is also shut down. Food for the restaurant is hard to come by. The Bel Air is renting some rooms to people who were displaced by the tsunami and some crews that have come to do repairs, but it's a skeleton operation. This elevator you see over here, he says, was down for a week and we had to use the emergency stairs. He says with so many problems across the region, it's been hard to book technicians to come and check the elevators or the air conditioning units. Despite only minor damage from the earthquake, Kono says the Bel Air may not reopen fully until the 1st of May. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.